Not really. Not a lie. You told me categorically no one left that cabin. And then I find out from Cole not only that you did leave, but anyone else could have left too while you weren't there. But that's different, he muttered. I left, God, I don't know when, but it was early in the evening. It wasn't round the time you were talking about. So why lie about it? It wasn't a lie. I just didn't think. Jesus, Lo. But I didn't let him finish. I pulled my wrist out of his grip and hurried away through the door and into the corridor, leaving him gaping after me. I was so busy thinking about Ben that as I rounded a corner, I careered into someone. It was Anne. She was leaning back against the wall as if steeling herself for something, although whether to return to the party or make her way back to her cabin, I wasn't sure. She looked extremely tired, her face grey, the shadows around her eyes darker than ever. "Oh, I'm so sorry," I gasped. And then, thinking of the bruise on her collarbone, "I didn't hurt you, did I?" She smiled, the fine skin around her mouth crinkling, but the expression didn't reach her eyes. "I'm fine. I'm just very tired. Sometimes," she swallowed, and her voice cracked for a moment, something in the cut-glass English accent slipping. "Sometimes it all just seems too much. Do you know what I mean? Such a performance." "I do," I said sympathetically. "If you'll excuse me, I'm going to bed," she said, and I nodded and turned to make my own way aft down the flight of stairs that led to the rear set of cabins. I was almost at the door of my suite when I heard an angry voice from behind me. "Lo! Lo, wait! You can't make those kinds of accusations and walk away!" Shit. Ben. I felt a strong urge to slip inside my cabin and slam the door, but I made myself turn to face him, my back against the panelling. "I didn't make any accusations. I just said what I'd been told." "You pretty much implied you're suspecting me now. We've known each other more than 10 years. Do you realise how that makes me feel? That you could accuse me of lying like that?" There was genuine hurt in his voice, but I refused to let myself soften. It had been Ben's favourite tactic in arguments when we were together, to divert the discussion away from whatever was annoying me to the fact that I'd hurt his feelings and was acting irrationally. Time and again I'd ended up apologising for the fact that I'd upset him, my own feelings completely ignored, and always, in the process, we'd somehow wound up losing sight of the issue that had provoked the disagreement in the first place. I wasn't falling for it now. "I'm not making you feel anything," I said, trying to keep my voice even. "I'm stating facts."
"Facts? That'd be ridiculous."
"Ridiculous?" I folded my arms.
"What does that mean?"
"I mean," he said hotly,
"that you're acting completely paranoid. You're seeing bogeymen behind every corner. Maybe Nielsen."
He stopped. I clenched my fist around my delicate evening bag, feeling the solid bulk of my phone beneath the slippery sequins.
"Go on."
"Maybe Nielsen."
"What?"
"Nothing." "Maybe Nielsen was right? Maybe I am imagining things?"
"I didn't say that."
"But it was what you were implying, right?"
"I'm just asking you to take a step back and look at yourself, Lo. Look at this rationally, I mean."
I forced myself to keep a hold on my temper and smiled. "I am rational. But I'm very happy to take a step back." And with that, I opened my suite door, stepped inside, and slammed it in his face.
"Lo!"
I heard from outside, and a thump on the door. Then a pause.
No!
I said nothing, just slid the bolt and chain across. No one was getting through that door without a battering ram, least of all Ben Howard.
No! He banged again. Look, will you just talk to me? This is really getting out of hand. Will you at least tell me what you're going to say to the police tomorrow?
He paused, waiting for me to reply.
Are you even listening?
Ignoring him, I threw my bag on the bed, stripped off my evening gown, and walked into the bathroom, shutting the door and turning on the bath taps to drown out his voice. When at last I stepped into the scaldingly hot water and turned off the taps, the only sound I could hear was the gentle hum of the extractor fan. Thank God. He must have given up at last. I had left my phone in the bedroom, so I wasn't sure what time it was when I climbed out of the bath, but my fingers were waterlogged and wrinkled, and I felt heavy with sleep, but in a good way, quite unlike the nervous, edgy exhaustion of the last few days. As I cleaned my teeth, dried my hair, and belted the white toweling robe around myself, I thought of the good night's sleep I would have, and the logical, carefully rehearsed story I would give to the police tomorrow. And then, Christ, I felt almost weak with relief thinking about it. Then I would get a bus or a train or whatever bloody transport Trondheim possessed and get myself to the nearest airport and home. When I opened the door to the cabin, I held my breath, half expecting Ben's hammering and shouting to start up again, but there was no sound. I walked cautiously to the door, my feet silent on the thick, pale carpet, and, lifting the cover to the spy hole, I looked out into the corridor. There was no one there, at least no one I could make out, in spite of the fisheye lens. I could only see part of the corridor, but unless Ben were lying on the floor beneath my door, he was gone. I let out a sigh and picked up my abandoned evening bag to check the time on my phone and set the alarm for tomorrow. I wasn't waiting for a call from Carla. I wanted to be up and off the boat as soon as possible. But my phone wasn't inside. I turned the bag upside down, shaking it out, but knowing it was fruitless. The bag was small and light, and there was no way anything heavier than a postcard could have been concealed inside. It wasn't on the bed. Could it have slipped onto the floor? I tried to think clearly. I could have left it at the dinner table, but I hadn't taken it out, and in any case I had a clear memory of feeling it inside my evening bag during the argument with Ben, and I would have noticed its weight missing when I threw the bag on the bed. I checked the bathroom in case I'd taken it in there on autopilot, but it wasn't there either. I began to search harder, throwing the duvet onto the floor, pushing the bed to one side, and that's when I saw it. There was a footprint, a wet footprint, on the carpet beside the veranda door. I froze. Could it have been me, getting out of the bath? But I knew that was impossible. I'd dried my feet in the bathroom, and I hadn't walked anywhere near that window. I moved closer, touching the cold, damp shape with my fingertips, and I realized it was the print of a shoe. You could see the shape of the heel. There was only one possibility. I stood up, slid back the veranda door, and went out onto the balcony. There, I hung out over the rail, looking round to the empty veranda to the left of mine. The frosted glass privacy screen between them was high and sheer. But if you were daring and had a head for heights and didn't mind the possibility of slipping to a watery grave, you could just get over it. I was shivering convulsively, my dressing gown no protection from the cold North Sea wind. But there was one more thing I had to try, though I was going to be very sorry and feel very stupid if it turned out I was wrong. Carefully, I dragged the veranda door closed and let it click into position. Then, I tried to pull it back. It opened, smooth as silk. I went inside and did the same thing, and then checked the lock. As I had thought, there was no way of securing the veranda door to prevent someone entering from the outside. It was logical, really, now that I thought about it. The only person who should be on the veranda was an occupant of the room. You couldn't risk someone accidentally locking themselves out there in bad weather, unable to get back inside and raise the alarm, or a child shutting a parent out there in a moment of rebellion and then being unable to work the lock. And really, what was there to fear? The veranda faced the sea. There was no possibility of someone accessing it from the outside. Except there was, if you were very bold and very stupid. Now I understood. All the locks and bolts and do not disturb signs in the world wouldn't do any good when the balcony offered a clear route to anyone with access to the empty room and enough upper body strength to pull themselves over. My room was not safe, and never had been. Back inside the suite, I got into my jeans, boots, and my favourite hoodie. Then I checked the lock on the cabin door and huddled on the sofa with a cushion hugged to my chest. There was no possibility of sleep now. Anyone could have access to the empty suite. And from there, it was just a short climb across the glass divide into mine. Any member of staff could open the empty cabin with their pass card. As for the guests, I thought of the layout of the cabins. To the right of mine was Archer's, ex-marine with an upper body strength that made me wince when I remembered it. And to the left was the empty cabin, and beyond that was Ben Howard's. Ben, who had deliberately cast doubt on my story with Nielsen. Ben, who had lied about his alibi. And he had known about the photos on Cole's camera before I did. His words came back to me as if in a dream. He was showing them to us over lunch. He had some great pics. Ben Howard. The one person on board I thought I could trust. I thought about the phone and the stupidity and daring of coming in to steal it while I was in the bath. He had risked a lot to take it, and the question was, why? Why now? But I thought I knew. The answer was Trondheim. As long as the boat's internet was down, the perpetrator had nothing to worry about. I couldn't make a call without going through Camilla Lidman. But once we started to draw closer to land, I hugged the cushion harder to my chest, and I thought of Trondheim. And Judah. And the police. All I had to do was make it until dawn. Who Done It? A discussion place for armchair detectives. Please read the forum rules before starting a thread and exercise caution in posting anything potentially prejudicial to live cases and or libelous. Posts that violate these guidelines will be taken down. Monday the 28th of September, 10:03. Missing Brit. I am Sherlocked.
Hey guys, anyone else been following this Lorna Blacklock case? Looks like they found a body.
The name's Marple Jane Marple.
I think you'll find it's Laura Blacklock, actually. Yes, I've been following it. Really tragic and sadly not that unusual. I read somewhere that more than 160 people have gone missing off cruise ships in the past few years, and almost none of those have been solved.
I am Sherlocked.
Yeah, I think I've heard that too. Saw in the Daily Fail that her ex was on board the ship. There was a big sobby interview with him saying how worried he is. He reckons she got off of her own accord. Is it me or is that a bit sus? Don't they say that a third of women are killed by exes or partners or something?
The name's Marple, Jane Marple.
A third of women are killed by exes or partners or something. I presume that you mean in the case of women who are murdered, a third of them are killed by a partner or ex, not a third of all women. But yes, that kind of proportion sounds plausible. And of course, there's the boyfriend. Something about his statement's not quite ringing true, and apparently he was out of the country at the time. Very convenient. Not that hard to get a plane to Norway, right?
Anon Insider.
I'm a regular on WD, although I've name changed, as I don't want to out myself. And actually, I know something about this case. I'm a family friend. I don't want to say too much for fear of making myself identifiable or impinging on the family's privacy, but I can tell you Judah is completely devastated about Lo's disappearance, and I'd be very careful about implying anything to the contrary, or you'll probably find this thread gets taken down.
The name's Marple, Jane Marple.
Anon, I'd find your claims more convincing if you dropped the mask. And in any case, none of what I said above was libelous. I said I didn't personally find his statement convincing. Show me the libel in that.
Anon Insider.
Look, MJM, I'm not interested in debating this with you, but I do know the family very well. I was at school with Laura, and I can tell you, you're barking up the wrong tree. If you must know, Lo's got serious problems. She's taken medication for depression for years, and she's always been, well, I think unstable would be the kind way of putting it. I imagine that's the line the police will be looking at.
I am Sherlocked.
What? Suicide, you reckon?
Anon Insider.
Not really my place to speculate on the police investigation, but yes. That's my reading of it between the lines. If you notice, they're being very careful not to describe it as a murder investigation in the press.
Judah Lewis, 01.
A friend told me about this thread and I've registered to post this. And unlike Anon, this is my real name. Anon, I have no idea who you are, and to be honest, you can fuck off. Yes, Lo takes medication, although FYI it's for anxiety, not depression. And if you were really a friend of hers, you'd know that. But so do literally hundreds of thousands of people. And the idea that that automatically makes her either unstable, as you put it, or suicidal is fucking offensive. Yes, I was out of the country. I was in Russia working. And yes, they found a body, but it's not been identified as Lo, so at this stage it's still a missing persons investigation, which is why you've not seen any suggestion it's a murder investigation. Can you people remember? This is a real person you're talking about and not just your personal episode of Murder, She Wrote. I don't know who the admins of this shit show are, but I'm reporting this thread.
I am Sherlocked.
Unlike Anon, this is my real name. Not being funny, but we've only got your word for that, mate.
Mrs. Raisin, admin. Hi all. Sorry to say we agree with Mr. Lewis. This thread is straying into some rather unpleasant speculation, so we'll be deleting it. We obviously don't want to stop you discussing what's in the news, so feel free to take it elsewhere, but please stick to the reported facts.
Inspector Wallander.
So what about this Norwegian police scanner blog that is reporting a positive identification of Laura's body?
Mrs. Raisin, admin. We are now closing this thread.
Part 6. Chapter 22.
I was trapped. I wasn't certain where. Or how? But I had a pretty good idea. The windowless room was small and stifling, and I lay on the bunk with my eyes shut and my arms wrapped around my head, trying not to give way to the feelings of panic rising up inside me. I must have replayed the events a thousand times in my head through the rising fog of fear, hearing,
Again and again, the knock at the door as I sat on the edge of the sofa waiting for Trondheim and Dawn. The sound, though not particularly loud, was as shocking as a gunshot in the silent cabin. My head jerked up, the cushion falling from my hands onto the floor, my heart going a mile a minute. Jesus. I found I was holding my breath, and I forced myself to exhale, long and slow, and then inhale, counting the seconds. It came again. Not a rough banging, just a tap, tap, tap. Then a long pause and a final tap, as if an afterthought, slightly louder than the rest. At that last tap, I scrambled to my feet and made my way as quietly as I could to the door. Cupping my hand over the opening so that no telltale flash of light could betray my presence, I slid the little steel cover of the peephole open. Then, when my face was close enough to the glass to shield any grey dawn light from my window, I withdrew my fingers and peered through the fisheye. I don't know who I was expecting to see. Nielsen? Maybe? Ben Howard? I wouldn't even have been surprised to see Bulmer. But not for one minute did I imagine the person actually standing outside. Her. It was the woman from Cabin 10. The missing girl. Standing outside, like nothing had ever happened. For a minute, I just stood there, gasping like I'd been punched in the stomach. She was alive. Nielsen was right, and I'd been wrong all this time. And then she turned on her heel and began to walk down the corridor towards the door to the staff quarters. I had to get to her. I had to get to her before she disappeared behind that locked door. Slamming back the chain and the bolt, I wrenched open the door. "Hey!" I shouted. "Hey, you, wait! I need to talk to you!" She didn't pause, didn't even glance back over her shoulder, and now she was at the door to the lower deck, punching in the code. I didn't stop to think. I just knew that this time I wasn't going to let her disappear without trace. I ran. She was already through the staff door by the time I was halfway down the corridor, but I just caught the edge of the door as it was closing, pinching my fingers painfully, and then I wrenched it open and flung myself into the gap. Inside was darkness. The bulb at the top of the steps burnt out, or taken out, as I later thought. As the door swung shut behind me, I stopped for a second, trying to get my bearings, see where the top step was. And that's when it happened. A hand grabbing my hair from behind, another twisting my arm behind me, limbs grappling mine in the darkness. There was a short interval of panting, scrabbling terror, my nails in someone's skin, my free hand trying to reach behind me to get a grip on the thin, strong hand laced in my hair, and then the hand pulled harder, twisting my head painfully back, then ramming it forwards against the locked door. I heard the crack of my skull against the metal doorframe, and nothing. I came to in here, alone, lying on a bunk with a thin blanket over me. The pain in my head was agonizing, throbbing with a low pulse that made the dim lights in the room warp and shimmer with a strange halo effect around them. There was a curtain on the wall opposite, and with trembling limbs I slithered off the bed and half stumbled, half crawled across the floor towards it. But when I dragged myself upright, using the top bunk for support, and pulled back the thin orange cloth, there was no window there, just a blank wall of creamy plastic, lightly patterned, as if in imitation of textured wallpaper. The walls seemed to close in, the room narrowing around me, and I felt my breath come faster. One, two, three,
Breathe in. Shit. I felt the sobs rising up inside me, threatening to choke me from the inside. 4, 5, 6, breathe out. I was trapped. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. 1, 2, 3, breathe in. Propping myself against the wall with one hand, I made my way unsteadily back towards the door. But I knew before I tried it that it was useless. It was locked. Refusing to think about what that meant, I tried the other door, set into the wall at an angle, but it opened into a minuscule ensuite, empty except for a single dead spider curled in the wash basin. I stumbled back to the first door and tried again, pulling harder this time, straining every muscle, rattling the door in its frame, yanking so hard at the handle that the effort left me panting, stars exploding in my vision as I slumped to the floor. No. No, this was not possible. Was I really trapped? I got to my feet and looked around me for something to lever into the door, but there was nothing. Everything in the room was bolted or screwed down or made of fabric. I tried forcing the handle again, trying not to think about the fact that I was in a windowless cell, maybe 4 foot by 6 and well below sea level, 1,000 tons of water just inches away behind a skin of steel. But the door didn't move. The only thing that changed was the pain in my head, jabbing with neon intensity, until at last I stumbled back to the bunk and crawled onto it, trying not to think about the weight of water pressing in on me, focusing instead on my aching skull. It was pounding now so that I could feel my pulse in my temples. Oh, God! I had been so stupid, running out of that room straight into the trap. I tried to think. I had to stay calm, had to keep my head above the rising tide of fear. Stay logical. Stay in control. I had to. What day was it? It was impossible to tell how much time had passed. My limbs felt stiff, as if I'd been lying in that position on the bunk for a while. But although I was thirsty, I wasn't completely parched. If I'd been unconscious for more than a few hours, I would have woken up seriously dehydrated, which meant it was probably still Tuesday. In which case, Ben knew that I'd been intending to go ashore at Trondheim. He would come looking for me, wouldn't he? He wouldn't let the boat leave without me. But then I realized that the engine was running, and I could feel the rise and fall of waves beneath the hull. Either we hadn't stopped at all, or else we'd already left the port. Oh, God. We were heading back out to sea, and everyone would assume I was still in Trondheim. If they looked for me at all, it would be in completely the wrong place. If only my head didn't hurt, and my thoughts didn't keep stumbling over each other. If only the walls weren't closing in on me like a coffin, making it hard to breathe, hard to think. Passports. I didn't know how big Trondheim Port was, but they must have some kind of customs check or passport control. And there would be someone from the ship on duty at the gangway, surely checking passengers in and out. They couldn't risk leaving without someone. Somewhere there would be a record of the fact that I hadn't left the boat. Someone would realize I was still here. I had to hang on to that. But it was hard. Hard when the only light was a dim bulb that flickered and dipped every so often, and the air seemed to be running out with every breath. Oh, God, it was so hard. I closed my eyes, shutting out the looming walls and the claustrophobic, warping light, and pulled the thin cover over myself. I tried to focus on something. The feel of the flat, limp pillow beneath my cheek, the sound of my own breathing.
But the image I kept coming back to was of the girl, standing nonchalantly outside my door in the corridor, her hand on her hip, and then the swing of her gait as she walked towards the staff door. How? How? Had she been hiding on the boat all along? In this room, maybe. But I knew, even without opening my eyes to look around, that no one had been living here. It had no sense of being inhabited. There were no stains on the carpet, no coffee marks on the plastic shelf, no fading scent of food and sweat and human breath. Even that spider curled in the sink spoke of disuse. There was no way that girl, full of snapping life and vivacity, could have been in this room without leaving some impression. Wherever she'd been staying, it wasn't here. This place felt like a tomb. Maybe it was mine. Chapter 23. I wasn't sure when I fell asleep, but I must have done. Exhausted by the ache in my head and the roar of the ship's motor, because I awoke to the sound of a click. I sat up sharply, cracking my scalp against the bunk above, and then fell back, groaning and clutching my head as the blood pounded in my ears, a shrill ringing in the back of my skull. I lay there, my eyes squeezed shut against the pain. But at last it receded enough for me to roll onto my side and open my eyes again, squinting against the dim fluorescent light. There was a plate on the floor, and a glass of something. Juice, I thought. I picked it up and sniffed it. It looked and smelled like orange juice, but I couldn't bring myself to drink it. Instead, I got painfully to my feet and opened the door to the little ensuite, where I emptied the juice down the sink and refilled the glass with water from the tap. The water was warm and stale, but I was so thirsty now that I would have drunk worse. I gulped down the glass, refilled, and began to sip the next more slowly as I made my way back to the bunk. My head ached powerfully, and I wished I had some painkillers, but more than that I felt awful, shivery and weak, like I was coming down with flu. It was probably hunger. It was hours since I'd eaten, and my blood sugar must be at rock bottom. Part of me wanted to lie down and rest my throbbing head, but my stomach growled, and I made myself examine the plate of food on the floor. It looked completely normal. Meatballs in some kind of sauce, mashed potato and peas, and a bread roll on the side. I knew I should eat, but the same gut revulsion that had made me pour away the juice was kicking in. It just felt so wrong, eating food provided by someone who'd locked me into an underwater dungeon. There could be anything in there. Rat poison, sleeping pills, worse, and I'd have no choice but to eat it. Suddenly, the thought of putting even a spoonful of that sauce in my mouth made me feel panicked and ill, and I felt like flushing the whole lot down the drain along with the juice. But even as I half stood, ready to pick up the plate, I realized something, and sat back down again on slow, shaky legs. They didn't need to poison me. Why would they? If they wanted to kill me, they could just starve me. I tried to think clearly. If whoever had brought me here had wanted to kill me, they'd have done it, right? Right. They could have hit me again, harder, or put a pillow over my face when I was passed out, or a plastic bag around my neck, and they hadn't. They dragged me here at some inconvenience to themselves. So they didn't want me dead. Not right now, at any rate. One pea. You couldn't die from one poison pea, surely. I picked it up on the end of a fork and looked at it. Completely normal. No trace of any powder, no odd colour. I put it in my mouth and rolled it slowly round, trying to detect any strange taste. There was none. I swallowed. Nothing much happened. Not that I'd expected it to. I didn't know much about poison, but I imagined that the ones that killed you within seconds were few and far between and not easy to obtain. But something did happen. I started to feel hungry. I scooped up a few more peas and ate them, cautiously at first, and then picking up speed as the food made me feel better. I skewered a meatball with my fork. It smelled and tasted completely normal, with that slightly institutional air of food prepared for a large number of people. At last, the plate was empty, and I sat and waited for someone to come and collect it. And waited. And waited. Time is very elastic. That's the first thing you realise in a situation without daylight, without a clock, without any way of measuring the length of 1 second over the length of another. I tried counting seconds, counting my pulse, but I got to 2,000 and something and lost count. My head ached, but it was the weak shiveriness in my limbs that worried me more. At first I thought it was low blood sugar, then, after I'd eaten, I started to worry that perhaps there had been something in the food. But now I began to think back, to work out when I'd last taken my pills. I remembered popping one out of the packet right after seeing Nielsen on Monday morning, but I hadn't actually taken it. Some stupid need to prove that I wasn't chemically dependent on these innocent little white dots had stopped me. Instead, I'd left it on the countertop, not quite able to bring myself to down it, not quite wanting to throw it away. I hadn't been intending to stop, just to show, I don't know what, that I was in charge, I guess. A little pointless fuck you to Nielsen. But then the argument with Ben had driven it from my mind. I'd gone off to the spa without taking it, and then the episode with the shower. That made it at least 48 hours since I'd had a dose. Maybe more like 60 hours. The thought was uncomfortable. Actually, more than uncomfortable. It was terrifying. I had my first panic attack when I was, I don't know, 13. Maybe 14. I was a teenager. It came and went, leaving me frightened and freaked out, but I never told anyone. It seemed like something only a weirdo would get. Everyone else walked through life without shaking and finding themselves unable to breathe, right? For a while it was okay. I did my GCSEs, started my A-levels. It was around then that things started to get really shaky. The panic attacks came back, first one, then a couple. After a while, it seemed like coping with anxiety had become a full-time business, and the walls began to close around me. I saw a therapist, several, in fact. There was the talking cure person my mum picked out of the phone book, a serious-faced woman with glasses and long hair who wanted me to reveal some dark secret that would be the key to unlocking all this. Except I didn't have one. For a while, I thought about making one up, just to see if it would make me feel better. But my mum got annoyed with her, and with the bills, before I could come up with a really good story. There was the hip young community support leader with his group of young girls who ran the gamut from anorexia to self-harm. And finally, there was Barry, the cognitive behavioural therapist that my GP provided, who taught me to breathe and count, and left me with a lifelong allergy to balding men with soft, supportive tenor voices. None of them worked for me, though, or none of them worked completely, but I kept it together enough to get through my exams, and then I went away to university, and I felt a bit better, and it seemed like maybe all that that stuff was something I'd grown out of, like NSYNC and cherry lip gloss. That I'd left it behind in my old bedroom at my parents' house, along with all my other childhood baggage. Uni was pretty great. When I left with my shiny new degree, I felt ready to take on the world. I met Ben, and I got a job at Velocity in my own place in London, and everything seemed to be falling into place. And that was when I fell apart. I tried to come off the pills once. I was at a good place in my life. I was over Ben. Oh, my God, I was so over Ben. My GP lowered the dose to 20 milligrams a day, then 10. And then, since I was coping pretty well, to 10 milligrams every other day. And finally, I stopped. I lasted 2 months before I cracked. And by that time, I had lost 2 stone and was in danger of losing my job at Velocity, although they didn't know why I'd stopped coming into the office. At last, Lissy called my mum and she marched me back to the GP, who shrugged and said that maybe it was withdrawal, but maybe it just wasn't the right time for me to come off. He put me back on 40 milligrams a day, my original dose, and I felt better almost within days. We agreed to try again another time, and somehow that time never came. Now was not the right time. Not here. Not shut in a steel box 6 foot below sea level. I tried to remember how long it had taken last time, how long it had been before I started to feel really, really shit. It hadn't been that long from what I could recall. 4 days, maybe less. In fact, I could feel the panic begin to prickle over my skin in little, cold, electric shocks. You'll die here. No one will know. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh. There was a sound at the door and I stopped. Stopped breathing, thinking, panicking. I sat, frozen, my back against the bunk. Should I pounce? Attack? The door handle began to turn. My heart was pounding in my throat. I stood up and backed away against the far wall. I knew I should fight, but I couldn't, not without knowing who was coming through that door. Pictures flashed through my head. Nielsen, the chef in his latex gloves, the girl in the Pink Floyd t-shirt, a knife in her hand. I swallowed. And then a hand snaked through the gap and grabbed the plate, quick as blinking, and the door slammed shut. The light went out, plunging the cabin into inky blackness so thick I could taste it. Fuck. There was nothing I could do. I lay there in the impenetrable darkness for what felt like hours, but might have been days or minutes, drifting in and out of consciousness, hoping each time I opened my eyes to see something, even just a thin line of light in the corridor, something that would prove I was really here, that I really existed and wasn't just lost in some hell of my own imagining. At last, I must have fallen properly asleep, for I awoke with a jump, my heart thumping and fluttering erratically in my chest. The cabin was still in complete darkness, and I lay there, shaking and sweating, holding onto the bunk like a life raft as I clawed my way back from the most horrible dream I could remember in a long time. In the dream, the girl in the Pink Floyd t-shirt was in my cabin. It was dark, but somehow in the darkness I could not exactly see her, but sense her. I just knew that she was there, standing in the middle of the cabin, and I couldn't move. The darkness pressing me down like a living thing, squatting on my chest. She came closer and closer, until she was standing just inches away, the t-shirt skimming the tops of her long, slim thighs. She smiled, and then with one sinuous movement she pulled off the shirt. Beneath it she was skinny as a whippet, all ribs and collarbones and jutting pelvis,
her elbow joints wider than her forearm, her wrists knobbly as a child's. She looked down at herself, and then she pulled off her bra, slow as a striptease, except there was nothing erotic about it, nothing sexy about her small, shallow breasts and the hollow of her stomach. But as I lay on the bunk, panting, paralyzed with fear, she didn't stop there. She kept stripping. Her knickers slipped from her narrow hips to form a puddle at her feet, and then her hair, yanking it out by the roots. Then she pulled off her eyebrows, first one and then the other, and her lips. She let her nose drop to her feet. She drew out her fingernails one by one, slowly, like a woman loosening her evening gloves, and let them fall with a slight clatter to the floor, followed by her teeth, click, 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 one after another. And finally, and most horribly, she began to peel away her skin, as if she was stepping out of a tight-fitting evening dress, until she was just a bloody streak, muscle and bone and sinew, like a skinned rabbit. She went down on all fours and began to crawl towards me, her lipless mouth spread wide in a horrible parody of a smile. Closer and closer she crawled, until at last, though I backed away, I came up against the rear wall of the bunk and could retreat no further. I felt my breath whimper in my throat. I tried to speak, but I was dumb. I tried to move, but I was frozen with fear. She opened her mouth, and I knew that she was about to speak. But then she reached inside and pulled out her tongue. I woke, gasping and crawling with the horror of it, the blackness like a clenched fist around me. I wanted to scream, the panic built inside me like a volcano pressing up through the layers of closed throat and clenched teeth. And then, I thought in a kind of delirium, if I scream, what's the worst that can happen? Someone might hear? Let them hear. Let them hear, and maybe they'll come and get me out. So I let it out, the scream that had been rising up inside me, growing and swelling and pressing to get out. And I screamed and I screamed and I screamed. I don't know how long I lay there, shaking, my fists curled around the thin, limp pillow, my nails digging into the bare mattress beneath. I only know that at last it was quiet in the little cabin, except for the low roar of the engine and my own breath, rasping in a throat scoured raw and hoarse. No one had come. No one had banged on the door to ask what was going on, or threatened to kill me unless I shut up. No one had done anything. I might as well have been in outer space, screaming into a soundless vacuum. My hands were trembling, and I could not get the girl from my dream out of my head. The idea of her raw, moist form crawling towards me, clutching, kneading. What had I done? Oh, God, why had I done this? Kept pushing, kept refusing to shut up. I had made myself a target by my refusal to be silenced about what happened in that cabin. And yet? And yet, what had happened? I lay there, my hands pressed to my eyes in the suffocating darkness, trying to make sense of it. The girl was alive. Whatever I had heard, whatever I thought I had seen, it wasn't murder. She must have been on the ship all along, We hadn't stopped, we hadn't even got near enough to land to see it. But who was she? And why was she hiding on the ship? And whose blood had I seen on the glass? I tried to ignore my aching head, to think logically. Was she a member of the crew? She had access to the staff door, after all. But then I remembered Nielsen punching in the code, me standing behind him as he did. He'd made no effort to shield the keypad. If I'd wanted to, it would have been child's play to note down the numbers as he entered them. And after that, once you were below decks, there were not many further locked doors. She'd had access to the empty cabin, though. And that did require a keycard, either a guest one, programmed to that door specifically, or a staff one that opened all the cabin doors. I thought of the cleaners I'd seen in their little hutches below decks, their scared faces looking out at me before the door swung shut. How much would one of them sell a keycard for? 100 kroner? 1,000? They wouldn't even need to sell it. I was certain there were places you could get keycards copied. They would just have to loan it out for an hour or two, no questions asked. I thought of Carla. She had practically told me that it went on, that someone might have lent the cabin to a friend. But it didn't have to be that. The keycard could have been stolen, for all I knew, or bought off the internet. I had no idea how those electronic locks worked. There might have been no one else involved at all. Was it possible that all this time I had been looking for a perpetrator among the crew or passengers, and they'd been innocent all along? I thought of the accusations I'd hurled at Ben, the suspicions I'd had of Cole, of Nielsen, of everyone, and I felt sick. But the fact that this girl existed and was alive, that didn't automatically rule out someone else's involvement. The more I thought about it, the more I was sure that someone had been helping her above decks. Someone had written that message on the spa wall, had tipped Cole's camera into the hot tub, had stolen my phone. They couldn't all have been her. Someone would have seen and recognized the girl I had been shouting about for 2 days if she'd been wandering around the ship. Oh, this was making my head hurt. Why? That was the question I couldn't answer. Why go to such lengths to hide on board the ship, to stop me asking questions? If the girl had died, the cover-up made sense, but she was alive and well. It must be who she was that was important. Someone's wife? Someone's daughter? Lover? Someone trying to get out of the country with no questions asked. I thought of Cole and his ex-wife, Archer and his mysterious Jess. I thought of the way the photograph had disappeared from the camera. None of it made sense. I rolled over, feeling the weight of the darkness all around. Wherever I was, it was very deep in the ship. I was sure of that now. The engine was much louder than on the passenger deck, louder even than I remembered it being on the staff deck. I was somewhere else, on an engine deck, perhaps, far below the waterline, deep in the hull. At that thought, I felt again the horror begin to creep over me, the tons and tons of water weighing on my head and shoulders, pressing against the hull, the air in the cabin circulating, circulating, and me here suffocating in my own panic. My legs shaking, I climbed cautiously off the bunk and made my way slowly across the floor, my arms stretched out in front of me, cringing from what might be in here with me in the absolute darkness. My imagination conjured up horrors from my childhood nightmares. Giant spiderwebs across my face, men with clutching arms, even the girl herself. Lidless, lipless, tongueless. But another part of me knew that there was no one here but myself. That I would have been able to hear, smell, sense another human being in such a confined space. After a few moments' cautious inching, my fingers encountered the door, and I felt my way across it. The first thing I tried was the handle, but it was still locked. I hadn't expected anything else. I felt for a spy hole, but there was none, or none that I could find on the blank expanse of plastic. I didn't remember seeing one earlier anyway. What I did remember, and what I felt for next, was the flat beige light switch to the left of the door. My fingers found it in the darkness, and I pressed it, my heart beating hard in my chest. Nothing happened. I flicked it back, but without hope this time, because I knew what they'd done. There must be some kind of override in the passage outside, a master switch or fuse. The door was already shut when the light went out, and in any case, in any cabin I'd been in before, there was always some kind of security light. You were never in complete darkness, even when the lights were turned out. This was something else. This was an utter, total darkness that could only come from the electricity being completely cut. I crawled back to the bunk and beneath the covers, my muscles shaking with a mixture of panic and that sick, flu-like feeling I'd had before. My head felt filled with a spreading blankness, as if the dark of the cabin had seeped inside my skull and was filtering through my synapses, deadening and muffling everything apart from the panic that was building in my gut. Oh, God. Don't. Don't give way. Not now. I couldn't. I wouldn't. I wouldn't let her win. The anger that flooded over me suddenly was something that I could hang on to, something concrete in the silent blackness of this little box. That bitch! What a traitor! So much for the fucking sisterhood. I had fought for her, put my credibility on the line, endured Nielsen's doubt and Ben's probing, and all for what? So that she could betray me, bash my head into a steel doorframe and lock me into this fucking coffin? Whatever the plot was, she was in on it. She had definitely been the person who had ambushed me in the corridor. And the more I thought about it, the more I was sure that the hand that had come snaking in to snatch my food tray was hers too. A skinny, lithe, strong hand. A hand that could scratch and slap and smack a person's head against the wall. There must be some reason for all this. No one would go through this elaborate charade for nothing. Had she been faking her own death? Had I been meant to see what happened? But if so, why go to such lengths to pretend she was never there? Why clear the cabin, wipe away the blood, destroy the mascara, and deliberately discredit everything about my account of that night? No, she hadn't wanted to be seen. Something had happened in that cabin, and whatever it was, I was not supposed to have witnessed it. I lay there, cudgeling my battered brain to try to work it out. But the more I tried to ram the bits of information together, the more it felt like a jigsaw with too many pieces to fit the frame. I tried to think through the possibilities that would mesh with the scream and the blood and the cover-up. A fight? A blow to the nose, a yell of pain, a gush of blood as the person ran to the veranda to bleed into the sea, leaving that smear on the glass. No death. And if the girl was some kind of stowaway, that could explain why they had covered it up, moved her to a different location, cleaned away the blood. But other parts of the picture didn't fit. If the fight had been unintended and unpremeditated, how had they cleared the cabin so fast? I had seen the girl in situ earlier that day, the room behind her cluttered with clothes and belongings. If the fight had been unplanned, there was no way they could have stripped and cleaned that suite in the few minutes it had taken me to ring Nielsen. No. Whatever had happened in there had been planned. They had cleared it beforehand, meticulously cleaned it, and I was beginning to suspect it was not chance that it was cabin 10 that had been empty. No.